I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Thousands of American and Iraqi troops launched a major assault in Najaf today after a week of intensifying fighting in Iraq's holiest city. Militiamen loyal to the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have taken refuge in Najaf's Imam Ali Shrine and the vast cemetery surrounding it. Iraq's Prime Minister Iyad Allawi urged the militants again today to put down their weapons and leave the shrine. Washington Post reporter Carl Vick is in Najaf. We spoke with him just a short while ago.
The 7th Cavalry has set up a cordon around the old city of Najaf, which is probably physically about a third of the city, and it's where the sort of sacred site is, the shrine of Imam Ali. But within that cordon is most of the fighters there. They're worried about the militiamen. There's also been a Marine raid outside of that area, the home of Muqtada al-Sadr and a nearby hospital, a maternity hospital, where apparently fighters are being treated.
Carl, what are these American troops being told in terms of cautionary measures as they approach the shrine? We're hearing some reports that al-Sadr's troops have put weapons inside those shrines and mosques in the area. What are the Americans being told about how they should respond to that?
Well, it's a very problematical situation. The American soldiers and commanders and everyone is briefed very intensively on what they cannot do. They cannot fire in a direction that might inadvertently hit a sacred site. They were told when they were fighting in this vast cemetery that it's not a religious site, but it's a sacred cemetery, and it's where most Shiite Muslims would like to be buried.
And what did you see as you were traveling around the city this morning? There are some descriptions that it looks like a ghost city.
This is a pilgrimage city. I mean, normally it's jammed, teeming with Muslim, Shiite, and Sunni Muslim pilgrims who come from all over, like a trip to Disney World for secularists. I mean, this is the place to come in the Shiite Muslim world, and it's just that's all gone. I mean, those people aren't here, and a lot of the center of the city where the fighting has been is just emptied out.
You were mentioning a moment ago about how the soldiers are being briefed. Do they have explicit instructions in terms of what to do about Muqtada al-Sadr? Is this an offensive that is designed to get him one way or the other?
They say it's not. They say that he's a problem for the Iraqi government, and if they want to serve a warrant on him, they can. I think they see that as something to be left to the Iraqi police and what they call the legitimate Iraqi authorities.
Can you just give us, finally, a sense of what it's like visually being in this cemetery? Because, you know, for Americans trying to imagine what that must be like, the closest parallel I can think of is Arlington National Cemetery. Imagine, you know, it's not a religious area, obviously, a secular one, but, you know, would this be like this kind of gun battle playing out in a place like that?
I see what you're saying about the sacred part, but in terms of the physical description, it couldn't be any further from it. I mean, the thing about Arlington National Cemetery is the order of it, the orderliness and the regimentation of the white graves against green grass. This is, everything is jumbled and jammed together. One commander I talked to said it's like New Orleans meets Baghdad. I mean, most of the tombs are above ground.
And so a great place for guerrilla operations, sounds like.
Oh, it's very hard to fight. Very hard to fight. It's incredibly dense. Like, it's urban combat in miniature and concentrated.
Mm. Well, Carl, thank you so much, and stay safe.
Sure will. Thank you.
Carl Vick of The Washington Post speaking to us from Najaf.
The courtship between Wall Street and the website search engine Google has soured a little, and the relationship hasn't even been consummated. This afternoon is the deadline for potential investors to register in Google's unique public offering. But criticism in recent weeks has caused some to reconsider their early high expectations, and Google can't respond because of the gag order prior to an IPO. Well, joining us on the line is Michael Santoli, senior editor for Barron's. And Michael, Google is an enormously successful iconoclast founded by two friends from Stanford whose motto is do no evil. So why the negative press?
One of the reasons is that Google wanted to be unique in the way it went about raising money from the public. And in doing so, it made both the Wall Street firms that are underwriting the deal and public investors jump through a lot of hoops. And they made the underwriters put in all kinds of complicated systems to sort of run an auction so that the public could have access to the shares. And they made the public register in advance for this auction. And as it turns out, a lot of the brokerage firms that are handling the offering are setting lots of restrictions on exactly who can bid. So it's become a lot more complicated. And then, of course, there are things that about this offering that are going to cause the price initially to be rather high and much higher than a lot of people had anticipated, which is going to make it both expensive and probably will also limit how much the stock might appreciate immediately after the offering.
Well, we want to hear a little bit more about that, but we understand there are other problems. There was a patent dispute with Yahoo,
Absolutely.
Another engine, a negative turn in the economy.
Sure. I mean, the actual economics of it have been difficult, too, because they did, in fact, settle this dispute they had with Yahoo, which is considered to be a net positive, but they're going to be required to give lots of shares, 2.7 million shares, to Yahoo in settlement of that dispute. You know, some of the other criticisms here is that, you know, management is retaining, almost entirely retaining control of the company, even though it's going to go public because they're going to have shares that count for more votes than the public will.
Okay, well, here's the hard part. In very simple layman's terms, can you just outline briefly the normal public offering and then, again, a little bit more about the Google process.
Sure. The normal public offering, Wall Street firms go to big investors like mutual fund managers, and they attempt to gauge their demand for the stock, and they effectively set a price and the amount of shares that are going to be sold, and they basically kind of broker the transaction between the investors and the company.
And it's very cozy because these are their close clients and friends.
It's relatively cozy, yes. I mean, the Wall Street firms have to kind of serve two conflicting masters here, the company that wants to sell stock at the maximum price and the investor that wants to get a good deal. Mm. So they have to kind of get somewhere in the middle there so they don't anger either of those parties.
And the Google process?
All of these public investors are going to say they are going to bid the price they are willing to pay for a certain number of shares. And Google will effectively take in all those bids and decide on the single price at which it can sell all the shares it wants to sell. So effectively, all the investors get the same price in the end. So if you bid too far below that price, you will not get any shares. If you bid above that price, you will get those shares, but at the lower price that that is set by the auction process. Mm-hmm. It's fairly complicated, but it's a rather efficient way of doing things.
But is it a good investment?
Well, it might not immediately be a very good investment. And, you know, one of the ways that Google has arrived at what it thinks its stock is worth somewhere above $100 a share is by comparing the valuation of its company to something like Yahoo, which is also very expensive relative to other stocks. So it's simply not clear that this is going to deliver much immediate appreciation, if any appreciation at all.
So let's say it's not as great a public offering as people initially thought. Does this mean anything about Google? In other words, are we still going to be Googling months down the road?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think the product itself has got a long life ahead of it and absolutely dominant position in the search business. And in fact, one of the only reasons that Google is able to go this unique route with its IPO is because it has such massive public recognition and virtually everybody uses it. Therefore, they already have the familiarity. They don't need somebody else to come in and convince them of the worth of this company because they intuitively know it.
So, in fact, this story today is really only a story about people who invest and people who want them to invest in them.
That's right.
Michael, thank you.
Okay.
Michael Santoli is senior editor for Barron's magazine.
Stem cell research is turning into one of the hottest issues so far in the presidential campaign. At the Democratic National Convention last month, Ron Reagan delivered a passionate speech about lifting federal restrictions on stem cell research to help find cures for diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes. First Lady Laura Bush jumped into the fray this week when she said anyone who claims a cure for Alzheimer's might be just around the corner is just not right. So, how close are the cures? How useful are the stem cell lines now being used for research? And why is the Bush administration imposing restrictions? Evan Snyder is program director for stem cells and regeneration at the Burnham Institute in California. And Evan, can you begin by reminding us what stem cells are and where they come from?
I think the simplest way to think about stem cells as being the most primitive cells of the body or the most primitive cells of a given organ. And they fall into two large categories. One we call embryonic stem cells, and those come from the egg shortly after it's been fertilized as it starts forming a ball of cells. Then afterwards, those cells begin to learn what their address is meant to be, and they begin to then give rise to the many different kind of cells that make up a particular organ.
These are cells that could be used in any number of places in the body.
Exactly.
Now, some people say that this investigation can be conducted on the stem cell lines that already exist, that you don't need to make any more. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think anybody who's ever worked in science, but quite frankly, anybody who's ever worked in a rapidly advancing field, recognizes that things move very quickly. The lines that we have right now reflect what we thought was going on in the mid-90s. We've learned so much more. We can do so much better. Is the computer that you're using today the computer you used in 1995? Even though in 1995 you thought you were buying the top of the line, the best.
And so why is creating new stem cell lines so controversial?
Well, I think this gets down to the heart of how does one begin to make these lines, and it starts really tunneling deep into people's theological and ethical roots. What one needs to do is pull out these cells from the earliest stages after fertilization of an egg or even getting the egg to start dividing. In these earliest stages, if you dissipate this ball of cells, have you destroyed a life? Have you destroyed a person? And that's where the moral dilemma sits.
Well, let me go back to the original question then. How close are we to cures for things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and diabetes?
I don't think we can lump all diseases together. We're closer in some and further away in others, and a lot of it depends on our knowledge of the disease. So, for example, there are certain diseases which are not as famous as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, but we actually know a lot more about them. Alzheimer's disease is a very, very complex disease. We don't even know what causes Alzheimer's yet. However, we're starting to learn that certain aspects of what stem cells do that never were known before might actually be applicable. In other words, a stem cell can bring in a therapeutic protein. It can decrease inflammation. So I think scientists, when they look at this field, are exceptionally excited. They can feel that something is happening and that this is a whole new paradigm shift, and we've got to have the ability to do unfettered research and to let the data and not policy dictate what the next experiment should be, assuming it's done in a rigorous, thoughtful, ethical manner.
Evan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Evan Snyder is Program Director for Stem Cells and Regeneration at the Burnham Institute in California.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Iran's President Mohammad Khatami said yesterday his country is willing to pay the price of diplomatic isolation to pursue a peaceful nuclear program. This on the same day that Iran successfully test-fired a new improved missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead as far as Israel. 2 years ago, international inspectors discovered Iran's nuclear program was more advanced than they thought. Since then, Europe and the U.S. have played good cop, bad cop with Iran. The problem is, if Iran decides to build a nuclear weapon, experts aren't sure if either approach can stop it. Brenda Schaefer is a fellow at the International Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, Dr. Schaefer.
Hello.
And also joining us is Andrew Koch. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly. He joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
And Dr. Schaefer, to you first. It just seems as if Iran is suddenly back on the radar this week. We know it's prompted in part by a New York Times article talking about the U.S. inability in some ways in this article to deal with Iran's weapons program. But why else do you think this is happening now?
I think there's basically three reasons. One, it's actually become a campaign issue in the United States. Both Senator Kerry and President Bush realize it's intrinsically linked to the whole issue of nuclear terrorism, which is probably the biggest threat to U.S. security. I think another reason is that Condoleezza Rice seems to assess that the U.S. and Europe are now on the same page. I'm hearing sort of similar voices from Europe, where they realize the engagement that they tried in the last year, the more carrots and sticks really didn't work. We're a year past since Iran and the European powers signed an agreement, and really nothing's happened except that Iran has progressed with its nuclear program. And probably the third reason, in September, there'll be the latest report of the International Atomic Energy Agency trying to give its new verdict on Iran.
Hmm. And Andrew of Jane's Defense Weekly, it's in the news as well for you because you ran a story this week, and yesterday European diplomats confirmed it, saying that one of the key causes of suspicions about Iran's intentions may have been put to rest. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. The key issue of Iran has been, how did it gain its ability to enrich uranium through what's called centrifuges? Iran has the right to have those centrifuges, but must tell the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a UN nuclear watchdog, so that the IAEA, as it's called, can do inspections of that process and of those facilities. Iran was discovered to have had enriched uranium on some of the equipment, but couldn't explain how that uranium had gotten there. That appeared to have been a smoking gun to show that Iran had cheated. However, it came out later, and Iran later admitted that, in fact, it had bought the equipment from overseas through a nuclear smuggling network. And Iran's explanation was that the equipment must have been contaminated. It has now been discovered by the international inspectors that, in fact, two of the major sources of contamination have been proven to have been from outside Iran on that equipment, and therefore the major smoking gun, as it were, seems to have been removed.
And this equipment was bought on the black market from the Pakistani black marketer who was selling the equipment, and so the contamination came from his end.
That's right. His name is Dr. A.Q. Khan.
Well, Brenda, let me ask you, does that remove the smoking gun for you? I guess the question everyone wants to know, those of you with an educated viewpoint about this, do you think Iran is developing a nuclear weapon?
I would say from a proliferation perspective, I don't find this very comforting to know that actually the equipment was imported on a nuclear smuggling market from Pakistan clandestinely and not reported, to any of the authorities. Maybe it would be a sign that Iran isn't as advanced as we think in terms of its domestic uranium enrichment. But I don't think this should be sort of comforting to us to know that it was imported illegally and clandestinely and not produced domestically.
Andrew, how is the intelligence and the defense community responding to this news?
What the inspectors, from my understanding and my reporting, are saying is that in that September report, they're going to say that there are issues with Iran. However, the major issues have now been resolved, and therefore they don't have any evidence to confront the Iranians with. And I guess the majority view that I'm hearing out of Europe, and it seems to be the majority view amongst the analysts at the agency that are looking at this, is that what policy do you want to follow? They look at 2 years of inspections in Iran, and they know a lot more today than they did 2 years ago, certainly more than U.S. intelligence knew at that time. And they see it, while it's been a difficult process, they see it as something that's produced a fairly good result to date. And I guess many of them question, what would you do that would actually change the behavior of Iran that would have a positive result?
Is this why, both of you, just in a few seconds we have, is this why Iran keeps going on and off our radar? Because no one really knows what to do with it. You're smiling here anyway. Dr. Schaefer?
Yeah, I think that basically the whole Iranian case and in a certain degree the North Korean case reveals the basic lack of success of the whole non-proliferation treaty regime, the IAEA. I mean, as much as we have these regimes in place, these treaties, but they're really not sufficient, because basically what happens when a country wants to produce nuclear weapons, it stays within the framework of the non-proliferation treaty, and when it gets really close to the weapon, it just withdraws from the treaty, and then what do you do? And again, the minute North Korea and Iran threatened to pull out of the treaty, you see all this sort of diplomatic tiptoeing and acrobats and to do anything to stay within the treaty, because really we don't have anything else. Even all these discussions we're having, all this jargon, uranium, centrifuges, all these different terms. I mean, we know this is a country, Iran is a country awash with oil and gas, has more natural gas than it can ever sell. All the countries next to it are natural gas producers. And when they tell us it's for peaceful production of energy, we kind of believe it because it's within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I mean, basically, we need something bigger and better in order to prevent more states from going nuclear.
Andrew?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the current system clearly has major failures and needs reforming, and I would think all sides would agree with that. The problem has been that there's no international consensus or agreement on how best to proceed. And these kind of agreements only really work if there is international consensus. Having a few states tell everybody else what to do has proven itself not to work and has been ineffectual. And right now, that's kind of why it's been at an impasse.
Well, I want to thank you both.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Dr. Brenda Schaefer is a fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Andrew Koch is Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Three accused drug dealers in Western Massachusetts were released by a judge this week because no lawyer would defend them. As in most states in the country, defendants in the Bay State who can't afford legal fees are represented by private attorneys appointed by the courts. In Massachusetts, many of these attorneys, known as bar advocates, say the state doesn't pay them enough to represent poor clients. As a result, they are refusing to take the cases. Judges who are finding themselves in courtrooms without a defense attorney present say more defendants will be freed if the attorneys continue to turn down indigent clients. WBUR's Monica Brady Meyerhoff has this report, which begins in Lynn, Massachusetts.
In Lynn District Court, so many bar advocates are dropping out of the state-run system that for the first time in Judge Joseph Dever's 17 years on the bench, no court-appointed attorneys showed up on Monday.
I can't describe the feeling. Absolute frustration. Here's a defendant charged with a serious crime, and there is no lawyer available to respond to a legitimate request for bail by the district attorney. And to detain anybody for an hour to deprive them of their liberty is very difficult. And to do it without the right to counsel, I mean, that's a state constitution, the federal constitution. It's absolutely awful.
In July, the state Supreme Court ruled it is unconstitutional to hold poor criminal defendants in Hamden County without a lawyer. This week, the first accused criminals were released. But around the state, a quiet walkout of court-appointed lawyers has led to the automatic detention of more than 100 people because they don't have representation. Unlike earlier in the week, yesterday there were two bar advocates taking cases in Judge Dever's courtroom.
We are charged with two offenses that carry with them the possibility of a prison term. Therefore, you are entitled to an attorney, and if you can't afford a lawyer, the court will appoint one for you. Are you asking the court to appoint you an attorney?
Yes, sir.
Court appoints attorney William Hernan to represent you.
Outside the courtroom, Lynn lawyer William Hernan says he needs a raise, but he enjoys the work and says it's important, so he will continue to accept court appointments.
I've been doing it long enough to know that people need to have representation. You can't rely on the system as it is to always work properly or work fairly. And just because someone doesn't have the funds available, they shouldn't be without representation.
Court-appointed attorneys cannot be forced to take cases. They volunteer to join the program and are assigned duty days. They mostly do criminal cases, but are also assigned to represent mentally ill clients or children who have been removed from their homes by the state. Peter Russell has been a bar advocate in New Bedford for 16 years.
It's a passion. I was just drawn inexorably to represent people who have spent their lives or a better part of their lives feeling powerless and find themselves up against the system. And I don't know, it's kind of the Lone Ranger syndrome, I guess.
But Russell says he's lucky if he clears $5 an hour after paying his expenses. And with a mortgage and three kids in college, he is now only accepting clients who will pay his full rate. Private criminal lawyers earn between $100 and $300 an hour. The state pays many of the same lawyers $37.50 an hour for district court work and more for superior court and murder cases. Until last Friday, when the legislature gave bar advocates a 25% raise, the rate had been $30 an hour for the last 20 years. Most bar advocates are self-employed and represent both private and publicly funded clients. They must pay their own office help, taxes, health insurance, malpractice, and a myriad of travel and office-related expenses. Because of this, after 20 years representing poor accused criminals, attorney Chris Burke of Lynn has withdrawn from the system. Still, Burke believes bar advocates are essential to fairness in criminal justice.
If you just continually put your money into building up the probation department, spending on police and law enforcement, and also hiring more prosecutors and support staff for their offices, and you don't pay public defenders, you know, a fair rate, then you lose the good people in the public defender side of things, and it just creates a huge imbalance in court.
The Massachusetts Association of Court-Appointed Attorneys formed last year to lobby the legislature for a pay raise. It says if the hourly rate set in 1984 is adjusted for inflation, bar advocates should be paid $64 an hour for district court work, $90 for superior court, and $120 for murder cases. Governor Mitt Romney is angry with the situation. Yesterday, he submitted legislation that would put the agency that manages public defenders and bar advocates under his control. Romney says if necessary, he'll call the legislature back into session to make the change. He wants to force private attorneys who've signed up for the program to represent clients or be barred from the state system.
The idea that anyone in any time would say, I want more money or criminal defendants are going to go free, that's just outrageous and unacceptable in our society in this day. And if they have a beef with getting paid $37 an hour, there are a lot of other people who'd be happy to step forward.
Attorney General Tom Riley suggests those public defenders who are full-time state employees be forced to increase their caseloads to make up for the shortage. There are about 100 public defenders, compared with roughly 2,500 private bar advocates who handle about 80% of the cases. Hamden District Attorney William Bennett says releasing defendants because they don't have representation poses a serious public safety crisis.
Someone is going to be murdered, raped, or robbed. And what are we going to say to the victim's family after that happens? After the police have gone about arresting somebody, getting the evidence, coming into court, having a judge hold the person on bail, and now that person is going to be released because there's no lawyer to represent this individual.
Back in Lynn District Court, a woman with long blonde hair who asks not to use her name or alleged crime says her court-appointed attorney worked very hard on her case.
And without her, I would have never won my case. And I definitely did not have the funds to pay for an attorney. So I'm definitely one of those people that really, I'm very glad that there are people to represent us.
That report from WBUR's Monica Brady Myrov.
And this note, some 380,000 residents of the Tampa Bay area have been asked to evacuate because of Hurricane Charley. And officials say Tropical Storm Bonnie has come ashore near Apalachicola in Florida's Panhandle. This is the first time in almost a century two major storms are hitting the coast. The National Guard is standing by in Florida. A state of emergency has been declared. Tourists have been told to leave the Florida Keys, where winds from Hurricane Charley have strengthened to 90 miles an hour, and mobile home owners were ordered out earlier today. Both Bonnie and Charley could bring rain up the East Coast after hitting Florida, and flood watches have extended north to Pennsylvania and New York.
Still to come, in the late 90s, thousands of people fled the tiny island of Montserrat after a volcano erupted there. Some of them came to the U.S., but now the Department of Homeland Security says it's time for them to leave. We speak to a woman from Montserrat about what she and her daughter, a U.S. citizen, will do now.
You're listening to Here and Now. Bill Galatis and Chuck Samiotis are co-owners of Meze Estiatorio restaurant here in Boston, Massachusetts. But right now, they're in Athens, Greece, in fact, in another restaurant, at the foot of the Acropolis, making their final plea to be on the Greek Olympic baseball team. We reached Bill on his cell phone. Bill, make your case. Why should you and Chuck be on the team?
6 years ago, there was literally nothing here associated with the game, so one of the things that we decided to do was put a business plan together. And the business plan had two major objectives: help the Greeks put together a team for the Olympics, and also help establish baseball as a permanent sport in Greece once the Olympics conclude.
Right. You have...
And we've been very instrumental in both of those objectives.
You helped establish a league there 3 years ago. You've helped run clinics, helped build the baseball field?
Exactly. And today there are over 300 kids playing baseball in Greece in the three fields that we help build here.
Well, Bill, now, you and I have met. how to say this? As a baseball player, you make a great restaurateur.
Thank you.
How old are you? How much have you played baseball?
I'm 50. I'll be 51 next week, August 19th, and Chuck is 49, and we're both proud of our age. Chuck and I have been baseball fanatics ever since we were kids, and we know our skills are diminishing. We also thought at the same time that if we just try out to play one inning and get one at-bat, then we wouldn't make the effort a mockery. And it would also, for Chuck and I, it's a way for us to pay tribute to our grandparents that came from Greece. And it also is honoring our children as well. It's a way for us to try to inspire people that no matter, you can do anything as long as you put your mind to it. And here we are, you know, literally on the cusp of getting the nod to play.
Well, but, and that's so noble. But, Bill, this is the Olympics. I mean, do you think you really can compete on an Olympic level?
I really do. Chuck and I were invited to work out with the team this past November in Fort Lauderdale, and we can hold our own. Our heritage is very important to us, and Chuck and I believed on a grander scale that we could use baseball as a way to bridge the gap between the two countries.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what it feels like there right now?
It's very exhilarating. This city is absolutely ready for the Olympics. When Chuck and I started to walk around Athens yesterday and a little bit this morning, and we started to see some kids playing baseball, and then we found out from one of the coaches that they had over 200 practices the past 3 years to try to get some of these kids that were in this league that we started to try to make the team as well. It just was very pleasing for us to see kids play the game.
Well, Bill, we wish you and Chuck all the best in your efforts to get onto the Greek Olympic baseball team. But we're comforted by the fact that you're from Boston. So if you are disappointed, you'll know how to handle it.
Yeah, we've had a little over 86 years of that. But, Robin, our position is that if we make it, it'll be a spectacular moment for us. But if we don't, the game we love to play, we left it in the country that our grandparents came from. So in the end, there's no reason for us to be unhappy.
Bill Galatis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for the time.
Potential Olympian Bill Gelatis on his cell phone from a restaurant in Athens, Greece.
There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
8 years ago, Marsha Mead and nearly 7,000 others fled their homes on the tiny Caribbean island of Montserrat as a once-dormant volcano erupted into explosions of rock, ash, and toxic gas. Of those 7,000, about 300, including Marsha, settled in the United States under an immigration policy that allows people whose living conditions are temporarily disrupted elsewhere to come here. Mead, then pregnant with her now 7-year-old daughter, made her home in Boston, where she works as an administrative assistant at a local college. Now, nearly a decade later, the Department of Homeland Security says Marsha Mead and everyone else from Montserrat who settled in the U.S. has to leave, not because it's safe to go back home now, but because it isn't. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the volcanic activity causing the environmental disaster in Montserrat is not likely to cease in the foreseeable future. Therefore, it's not a temporary disruption. Therefore, immigrants from the island don't qualify for temporary immigrant status. Well, Marsha Mead joins us in the studio. Thanks for coming in. And Marsha, how much of a surprise was this for you?
I think everyone was completely taken by surprise. My cousin from New York actually called me the Wednesday morning after the notice was published on the INS website and said, well, Marsha, guess what? And I'm like, what? And she said, you know, we have to go, we have to leave. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, Tom Ridge has terminated our status effective February of next year. I said, are you kidding me? And she said, well, she doesn't really know why, but it just happened.
Do you still have a home in Montserrat?
To my knowledge, it was destroyed. No one has been able to go back, at least I haven't been. So I have no idea if it still exists. My parents actually still remain there, and they have rebuilt a new home. They've had to rebuild a new home in order to reside there.
But the volcanic activity is such that you can't really walk over to that end of the island and figure out what's still there.
No, you can't. And you do that at your own risk. And the authorities have cordoned off that section of the island, and you have to request a special permission in order to go there.
So if you have to leave the U.S., where will you go?
Back to Montserrat and back to the northern section of the island, which, you know, hopefully will be there to welcome us, but I doubt it.
Now, your daughter was born here.
Yes.
So presumably she is a U.S. citizen. So Correct. She can stay, but you have to go?
She is technically able to live and reside in the United States because she is an American citizen by birth. But it's impossible. I mean, no one wants to leave their children here. This thing is going to be splitting up families, and that is not something that I wish to consider.
As far as you know, all of you folks from Montserrat are law-abiding citizens, not involved in terrorist activities?
We are not involved in terrorist activities, that's correct. We are peace-loving people. We are, you know, we believe in the rule of law. By extension, we are, quote-unquote, British subjects, and we support the American war on terrorism. In fact, Britain is perhaps one of America's greatest and staunchest support.
Well, and in fact, the Department of Homeland Security seems to feel that people like you, immigrants from Montserrat, should go to Great Britain, which still, as you say, governs the island. Is that a reasonable solution for you?
It isn't, for the simple reason that, I mean, from my knowledge and in the conversations I've had with British officials, we are not considered British citizens because we were living here. So we were not able to take advantage of the citizenship that was extended to those Montserratans who left directly from Montserrat and emigrated to London or, you know, parts of England. And they themselves were taken so much in shock by this whole thing from Tom Ridge that they have made no provisions, really, to welcome us and to resettle us. You're talking about resettling 292 people plus their families, you know, under any circumstances. That's a tall order.
Well, it certainly sounds as if you are betwixt and between at this point.
Yeah, even if you go home to Montserrat, where, quote-unquote, that's considered home, living on one-third of an island that originally housed, you know, 12,000 people, settling on less than 4 square miles, which is probably less than the size of Cambridge, It's where, you know, there's not enough land. The topography of the island is incredibly hilly. So you don't have that much land access to resettle people and construct houses. And if you're asking a government that is, you know, cash-strapped at this time to, you know, absorb that population, that's a tall order.
When you say Caribbean island, I think most of us think of some version of paradise. I wonder if you'd describe for us what your life was like before the volcano erupted. Is it a beautiful island, or is it one of the drier, dustier ones?
It's mountainous primarily. It's lush. The vegetation is green. It's verdant. We had a waterfall, which has also been damaged by the hurricane. We had, you know, a lot of marine life. The diving was excellent. The beaches, even though they are black sand, are completely unspoiled or were completely unspoiled. It was just a warm, friendly, welcoming place. It was safe.
So before the volcano erupted, you would have been perfectly happy to spend the rest of your days there, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, like most of us, most people my age, I was coming back 2 months, right, from the University of the West Indies. So I had just completed my BS in management studies. So I was looking forward to going back home and working, you know, becoming involved in the whole, you know, process of the island and building the country. But, I mean, if you're faced with a natural disaster and being asked to choose between living and not knowing where you're going to be the next day, I think most people did like me and just opted, you know, to live.
Well, Marcia, thank you for coming in, and all the best in finding a home.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Marcia Mead is one of 292 immigrants from Montserrat now being asked to leave the United States.
And finally, this thought. The Olympic Games officially begin tomorrow. I'll be watching and thinking back to another Games when I became the first American injured in the Sarajevo Winter Olympics of 1984. Well, I wasn't actually in the Olympics. I was in my house, then in Los Angeles, sitting on the couch, watching on television with my sister and a friend. As usual, I marveled at the pair's figure skating. In my head, I am a figure skater. In reality, I had never at that point in my life even put on a pair of skates. I wept at the eloquence, the death spirals, the spectacular throws, the dramatic one-armed lift that I should never have attempted. It's one thing to wonder out loud, how do they do that? As the Canadian figure skating pair, I think it was Barbara Underhill and Paul Martini, glide across the ice, she raised high atop his outstretched arm. It's quite another to try it. My friend Chris is well over 6 feet tall. When he raised me up on one arm, I must have been over 8 feet in the air. For a few glorious seconds, I was an Olympic athlete. Then suddenly, I was an emergency room visitor. Crashing to the ground, I broke my ankle. To add insult to injury, as we raced dramatically into the UCLA emergency room, Chris half carrying me, we were met by orderlies running out with gurneys, shouting, "What happened?" Chris yelled back, "She fell, attempting the one-armed overhead lift of the Olympic pairs competition." And they all fell out laughing so hard we had to wheel ourselves in. My sister called her husband, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, covering the games in Sarajevo. I think his column the next day began, "The first American injury of the 1984 Olympics has occurred in a living room in Los Angeles," and so on. So I leave you with this cautionary tale. As the games begin tomorrow, remember the key word in armchair Olympian is the word armchair. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our gold medal production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Susan Richardson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns, Alexis Delvecchio, Pope Path, and Nick Weiss-Richmond.
Now coming to the platform, the senior producer of Here Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.